not paying sufficient attention to the droning voice over the PA system, but the sudden applause smacked me back to full awareness. I turned to see lines of well-dressed men and women filing out of doors on either side of the dais. Local and state police, along with a mix of Secret Service agents, stood facing the crowd, eyes watching. The 55 governors were coming into the room. "Grendel," I said, using Wilson's call sign, "we need to shut this down right now." "I'm on the phone with the chief of security." I lost whatever else he was going to say because suddenly a big man stepped out of the crowd and removed a folded sheet of cardboard that he spread wide as he raised it over his head. In big black letters it read, "Traitors to the American Way." And below that were the letters NFF, New Founding Fathers. But then another man held up a sign, "No government equals real freedom." All around the room, people, men and women, were raising signs. Some were slogans, but most had an acronym, a logo, or the actual name of some group. There were at least a dozen different extremist militia groups, including a few that had figured prominently in last year's BLM riots. But there were also Black Lives Matter signs, Blue Lives Matter, the Second Amendment Coalition, and others, including one claiming to be Antifa. The hall had suddenly become a microcosm of American political hot-button contention. White, black, and brown people were suddenly waving their placards and shouting, while on stage the governors stood in uncertain clusters, glancing at security, jabbering with one another, and a few trying to calm the protesters. In the crowd I could see everyone with a cell phone taking pics. There was not one part of this that made sense. All the protesters had used essentially the same tricks, sneaking signs in, and they were spaced too evenly, too thoroughly throughout the audience. The signs had a cliché nature to them, as if they were movie props intended to sell the theme of the moment, which, of course, they had to be. And another few pieces of the puzzle clicked into place. This wasn't misdirection to draw focus from going viral. I think this was plan A all along. Make sure the public got all those signs and, more to the point, each of those groups on cell camera videos. Give it just enough time for those pics and vids to land on Twitter and the other social media platforms. Then start a riot in this convention center. The big play may be capture or likelier kill as many governors as possible. There were groups planning that late last year but doing it piecemeal. Kuga never did things small. 55 governors, a big split between red and blue states, people seeded into the crowd who were likely legitimate, though politically manipulated, members of those groups, and maybe a goodly number of fixers playing roles. Let the whole country see that Americans were willing to up the ante and go big in the worst possible way, put it in a pot and stir until you have a new civil war. Kuga sold arms and was apolitical. He'd sell them to anyone, to everyone. He was creating a brand new and enduring client base. This plan was brilliant, and it was scary as hell, and I was right in the middle of it. I saw the exact moment when the choreography of disaster began. Two men, one white, one black, were yelling at each other, very loudly, and with a lot of jabbing of fingers inches from each other's faces. I know there's a lot of racism in America, but this was too picture perfect. A large white man with swastika neck tattoos and a black man with a do-rag and a t-shirt with a picture of George Floyd. "Shut this down," I yelled to Wilson or Church or whoever the hell was listening. I began making my way through the crowd, pushing past people, shoving some aside, holding up my fake ID announcing that I was Secret Service. I might as well have been invisible for all the good I accomplished, because by the time I reached the fringe of the circle of folks, all of whom were now screaming their hate, both the white man and the black man pulled guns. I tapped my comm unit. "Christ, send backup now!" The whole room became a war zone. Just that fast. Chapter 164. The Pavilion, Blue Diamond Elite Training Center, Stevens County, Washington. Mia ran fast, but the bullets were so much faster. Two of them caught her between the shoulder blades and punched all the air out of her lungs. She fell hard and rolled badly, coming to rest in a gap between two pines. The body armor had saved her life, but the impact had been tremendous. Pain seemed to pulse outward from both sides of her spine, and breathing was a real challenge. The minigun chopped at the trees, creating a cyclone of flying bark and pine needles. Mia crawled as fast as she could and tumbled over into a small natural depression as the forest above her was chewed apart. She tried to make sense of this. Clearly, the lightning bug hadn't knocked out all the electronics on those goddamned machines. Maybe the mini EMP bomb had been too far away, or maybe the K-110's computers were shielded. She didn't know, and in that moment, did not care. Something whipped by overhead and flew straight at the fighting machine. It was one of Andrea's crow drones. The birds were unarmed, but it paused in midair, hovering like a hummingbird right in front of the driver's face mask. The minigun's angle of fire went totally wild for a moment, and then stopped as the driver tried to swat the drone away. That gave Mia a chance, and despite the agony in her back and only spoonfuls of air in her lungs, she got to fingers and toes and scampered away through the brush. Bunny was still engaged in a running fight, pausing for 1 second only every few yards to turn and fire an explosive shell at the fixers. Four of them were on the far side of the K-110 that had fired at Mia, and they were using crowbars and hand spikes to clumsy another of the big crates toward the edge of the flatbed. Bell hammered at the crate, but the bulky container effectively blocked the fixers. Bunny knelt beside a tree, aimed, and fired, but his shot went high and hit the top of the crate instead of one of the fixers. The explosion blew off one side of the huge wooden box, and the fighting machine inside toppled out. The four men scattered, but one was half a step too slow, and the K-110 smashed down on his rear leg. He collapsed, screaming. The other men snuck under the truck and squirmed up and out again with the fallen machine as cover. Bunny saw a glint of metal and glass as the access hatch opened and a fixer wriggled inside. He fired at the cowling, but even though he scored a direct hit, the K-110 hummed to life. The ungainly device got to its feet and the driver brought the gun arms up. Bunny hit it again and again with high explosive rounds, but if it did any damage, he couldn't see it. He had more of the lightning bugs in his pocket, but he was way too far out of range. He was going to have to get a lot closer to try to fry those things. Just as he set himself to move, the second K-110 opened up with its machine gun, forcing him to turn and run for cover, going away from the thing. He glanced back as he ran and saw that the first machine had turned to return fire from the trees. Bell or Andrea, Bunny couldn't tell, and from that angle the thing was able to cover the attempt by one of the fixers to climb into the semi's cab. Chapter 165. East Texas Convention Center, La Borde, Texas. It was a brawl. It was a gunfight. It was total chaos. The white man and the black man who'd been yelling at each other both drew their guns and fired. What surprised me was that they actually fired. That made no sense if they were fixers. Was I possibly wrong about this being a staged fight? Had all Santoro and Kuga done was manipulate disparate groups into a situation where violence was inevitable? No, that was too convenient, too pat. The men fired as they tried to duck for cover. Neither hit the other, but the screaming civilians behind them were not as lucky. I saw a woman with an old MAGA hat fall, dragging her young son down with her. No way to tell if the kid had been shot. On the other side, a black man with gray hair and a preacher's Roman collar spun away, hands clamped to a bleeding stomach. Other people fell, though many were diving for cover. On the dais, police and security personnel were pushing the governors down into crouches and shoving them in stumbling runs toward the exits. But then the exit doors banged open, and that's when I knew that I'd been right about it all. Four big men emerged from the exits, a mix of races, all of them armed and moving as precise military units. These were the fixers, dressed in civilian clothes. No fancy body armor, no cybernetic fighting machines. Hopefully no goddamn explosives, but from their speed and the bellows of fury they howled into the air, I knew they were being driven by R-33, and they were both relentless and filled with rage as they plowed into the security teams. I saw so many people go down in the first barrage, cops, uniformed security, aides, tech staff, and some of the governors. No way to tell how many were hit or how badly. All around me, people were fighting, rioting, and again, no clear way of determining who was a militiaman or radical tricked into coming here, who was a fixer seeded into the audience, and who was just a civilian whose simmering political anger had boiled over. It was a true melee, a free-for-all. I saw all of this while moving. I pulled the Snellig, and as I ran through the thrashing crowd, shot anyone who'd been holding a placard, anyone holding a gun, anyone clearly going after a civilian. I wanted to get to the dais and take out the fixers, but there was a churning sea of people between me and them. A fat man with a huge beer belly and massive forearms got in my way and threw a head smasher of a punch at me. I ducked it, rammed my shoulder into that belly, and used him as a combination shield and battering ram as I slammed into the black man who'd accidentally shot the woman. I rose up, headbutting the fat guy. I stamped hard on his foot, splintering the bones, and leaned past him to shoot the white guy who'd nailed the preacher. Then I shot the black guy. All three went down, and I quickly knelt by the preacher. But he was dead, his eyes staring up with profound surprise at the heavens. As I turned toward the woman with the kid, I saw someone else kneeling to help. Good. As I rose, something hit me hard on the back, and I whirled to see a very old white woman with an umbrella. She began hammering at me and calling me some of the filthiest names I'd ever heard. I let Sandman hush her up, but I caught her as she fell and laid her gently on the floor. Her hand flopped over and lay almost precisely in the outflung palm of the dead minister. I wonder if that would trend on Twitter. Yeah, the world was mad. I began moving, firing at active shooters, avoiding counterattacks by the dazed and confused. When I was within 10 feet of the dais, a voice rang out, sharp and clear, even with all the ambient furor.
Ledger!
My name had been yelled with such anger and shock that it jolted me. I turned and looked up, and there, on the stage, was Rafael Santoro. Chapter 166. The Pavilion, Blue Diamond Elite Training Center, Stevens County, Washington. The K-110 on the back of the semi bashed the Crow drone away, sending it tumbling and broken into the grass beside the truck. More of the bird drones swarmed in, but the fighting machine simply ignored them and kept pouring covering fire into the trees. The sheer destructive power of the minigun was denuding the slope of trees and shrubs, destroying any chance for a stealthy advance. Fixers were now swarming up onto the semi and attacking the remaining packing crates. Two of them began tossing body armor to the others who ducked down to gear up, but they froze as an explosion sounded deeper inside the pavilion complex.
"Pappy!" yelled Bunny into his comms. "Where the hell are you?"
"On my way, farm boy," came the reply.
"Hurry the hell up, old man!"
Was that a laugh he heard or a curse? Hard to tell with all the noise. He was out of the effective range of the minigun and well beyond the useful range of his own weapons, so he broke into a run as he began a wide circle. The fact that the camp was deliberately smothered by thick trees was a blessing in disguise because it allowed him to make maximum use of cover. Movement ahead made him drop to one knee and freeze beside an old oak. Two fixers in full armor were running down the slope toward the road. They must have come from another guard post and managed to suit up before joining the action. They were heading directly his way, but he didn't think they'd spotted him yet. Bunny weighed his options. Let them pass and use their approach to disguise his own, or ambush them and at least try to cripple both to prevent them from joining the fight. He was familiar with the fixer body armor now and knew that there were vulnerable points. No armor made could protect every single area of the body. The need for flexible and nimble movement came with a price. That was half the challenge. The other half was to stop them without killing either, because he didn't think he could outrun the resulting blast. He swapped the drum of explosive rounds for double-aught buck, and as they ran past, he opened up on full auto from 12 feet. The heavy sprays of buckshot scythed through the flexible knee joints, and both fixers screamed as they fell. One of them lost his entire lower leg in a grotesque shower of bright blood. Bunny was up and moving before either had a chance to bleed out. He got all the way down to the road when that side of the hill seemed to tear itself free of the earth with a monstrous thunder strike of sound. Pieces of torn turf and shattered trees chased Bunny, hammered him, and finally smashed him to the ground. The blast plucked Mia out of her hiding place behind a massive dogwood. The leaves of the tree burst into flame as pieces of burning debris landed among the branches. Flash-burned and half-dazed, Mia staggered away, blinking and pawing away blood from her nose. She suddenly realized that she no longer held a gun. But when she looked back, the entire area around the dogwood was ablaze. The breeze was blowing from the north, pushing little dancing demons of flame into the tall summer grass.
"Oh, shit!"
she wheezed as she turned and ran. She slapped the Sig Sauer from her holster and held on to that for dear life, as much for its deadly potential as for a talisman. She reached the road ahead of the semi and saw that every one of the fixers was either firing toward the trees, where Bell's sniper fire had come, off to the east where she'd seen Bunny hightail it, or toward the explosion up the slope. No one was looking in her direction. Then there was a roar as the semi's big engine growled itself awake. Her heart sank because there were now 3 fighting machines on the back of the semi, with drivers in them. More than half of the fixers were aboard, too, using the rest of the packing crates as cover as they waited to simply be driven out of the firefight. She and her friends in Havoc Team had done a lot of damage, but not nearly enough. These fixers and their deadly weapons were going to escape. Gunfire erupted from 2 different points, the sniper rifle and an M5, on the far side of the loading area, which meant that Andrea had stopped playing with his toys and was joining the fight on the ground. The K-110 on the ground began stalking toward them, letting the incoming fire spend itself uselessly on its reinforced cowling. A few of the fixers clustered behind it, using it as cover as they and the machine went hunting. Mia knew she couldn't help Belle and Andrea. They would survive or fall on their own. She had to find some way of stopping that truck. A plan began to form in her head. A very, very bad plan. Chapter 167. East Texas Convention Center, LaBorde, Texas. The whole universe froze around us both. He was on the dais, standing over the body of a Secret Service agent, a dripping red knife in his hand. Blood pooled out around the agent, draining from a slashed throat. There was a fixer beside Santoro, and well behind him I saw Eve. She was staring too, her eyes bugged out with a mix of fear and malevolence. The whole room swam, and shadows crept in at the edges of my vision, the darkness asserting itself, needing to be fed. I stupidly wondered if the parking lot was now full of nightbirds. I raised the dart gun, but the crimson-eyed fixer flung himself at me. He was so fast I couldn't get out of the way, and the descending weight smashed me back and down. I twisted as I landed, though, and came up on top of the killer and brought the Snellig barrel up. But just as the fixer back at the processing plant had done, he slapped it away with such force the pistol went spinning out over the crowd. I wasted no time and dropped my knee into the pit of his stomach, parried his hands to one side, and drove my right thumb into his eye socket. There was an explosion of red, and he shrieked so loudly it hurt my head. Instead of writhing in agony, he punched me in the side hard enough to lift me off him. I crashed down and immediately rolled away as he hammered down with his fist. I pivoted on my hip and kicked him in the mouth. Enhanced or not, skin, muscles, bones, and tendons are still vulnerable. My kick knocked his jaw askew. I hopped to my feet and pulled my Wilson knife from its pocket sheath, thumbed it open with a flick of my wrist, and as the fixer lumbered up, I swept his foot out from under him, caught his hair as he fell, and cut his throat. Then I spun just in time to see Santoro shove Eve toward the backstage door.
No!
I yelled, and it came out weird, too big, too rough, too alien. It was the voice of the darkness speaking through me. Together, I and that destructive thing inside me. I leaped onto the dais and raced after them. But the door banged open, and another group of fixers came out of the back. I immediately turned and ran like hell. And saw, on the far side of the room, the main doors open and three people fight their way through the tide of escaping civilians. One was a short, dumpy young guy, another was a thin man of medium height, and the third was a tall woman with a heavy fall of midnight dark hair. They saw me and immediately began fighting their way in my direction. Harry Bolt, toys, and violin. Chapter 168. The Pavilion, Blue Diamond Elite Training Center, Stevens County, Washington. The K-110 moved like a predatory dinosaur, a velociraptor for the techno-age. The driver shifted from the minigun to a rocket launcher and sent grenade after grenade into the trees. The forest blew apart in sheets of flame and burning gas, and the machine walked into that hell. Andrea saw this from behind the corner of the compound's sewage pump house. He had lightning bugs, but the machine was still out of range.
Monkey balls, he said over and over again.
There was nowhere for him to go. If he stayed where he was, the fixers would find him in seconds. If he ran, he'd be exposed, because the next good cover was at least 30 yards away, across the firing range. The irony of that was not lost on him. His only option then was to wait, and in the last second before they cut him down, try to use the EMP bomb to stop the fighting machine.
Harry Monkey Balls,
he muttered and touched his chest over his heart, seeing the face of his husband and their little girl, aching that he would never see them again. Then he set his jaw, took the lightning bug in his hand, put his thumb on the switch, and waited for the end.
Baffanculo!
He yelled as he began to rise up. But then the wall of trees to the left of the approaching K-110 burst apart as another fighting machine slammed its way onto the road, firing grenade after grenade into the fixers. The men in body armor were hurled through the air like straw in a stiff breeze, and the K-110 staggered and crashed onto its side. Andrea stared in shock. And then he saw the words, Hot Mama, painted in big red letters on the side of the cowling. Top Sims had joined the fight. Chapter 169. East Texas Convention Center, LaBorde, Texas. Violin crushed me with a quick, fierce hug.
Thank the goddess you're alive, Joseph.
Working on it, I said. Thank whoever that you're all here. This is a shitstorm. How can we help? Asked Toys. I quickly explained the situation. Toys and Violin nodded. Harry looked confused and a bit scared, but he gave a nod, too. They all had standard handguns as well as Snellig's. I need a dart gun, I said, and Violin gave me hers. Thanks. Look, you three, do what you can out here.
Where are you going?
Asked Violin. After Santoro. Toys caught my eye for a moment, perhaps searching to see if I was alone inside my head. And although there was no warmth or kindness there, he gave me a nod, one fighter to another. Try not to kill anyone who's not a fixer, I said.
What about the militiamen?
Asked Toys. Feel free to dent them, but the courts can sort them out. The fixers are the true threat. You can kill every last one of those pricks.
Count on it, said Toys.
As for you, Joseph, said Violin, feel free to kill that evil little man.
I stole Toys's line.
Oh, you can definitely count on that.
We split up, and I ran for the dais once more. Some of the fixers who chased me back came at me, but I put them down. When I reached the doors to the back, I had the dart gun in one hand and my knife in the other. The darkness was welling up inside me, and I wondered if it wasn't time to let it hold sway over everything else that happened. Chapter 170. The Playroom, undisclosed location near Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada. Kuga was at his desk with three laptops open, a cell phone tucked between shoulder and ear, and several maps laid out on the top of his desk. Things were happening, but the timetable was screwed up. The driver of one of the transport trucks was jabbering about a hit at the pavilion. HK reported in that the venue for going viral was being emptied and her team of K-110s were not in position for the hit. She said that she thought someone was ghosting through her computer. Halfway through that call, her line went dead. But according to the breaking news on TV, the G-55 thing was exploding exactly as planned, and that was the big get. No matter how many of the governors they killed, racial and political tensions in the states were going to skyrocket, taking sales with them. The loss of the pavilion, if it indeed fell, and the failure at the concert venue were nothing compared to that. Not merely because he'd sell a lot of guns in America for the next dozen years, but because it was a model for domestic strikes with limited boots on the ground and limited liability. There were at least 37 client countries whose political leaders would be watching the same news. He looked up in surprise as the door to his study opened and Mr. Sunday walked in.
"What are you doing here?" said Kuga. "We didn't have a meeting scheduled."
"No," said Sunday, closing the door behind him. "This is a bit of a surprise call."
"Yeah, well, go make yourself a drink or something. I'm kind of in the middle of this right now."
Sunday walked over to the desk and, smiling like a crocodile, reached out and plucked the phone from Kuga's hand. Kuga blinked in frank astonishment.
"Hey!"
Sunday dropped the phone to the floor and stepped on it.
"What the hell are you doing?" demanded Kuga.
"Oh, just making sure you're paying attention, Harcourt."
"I told you before, don't ever call me that. Harcourt Bolton is dead."
"No," said Sunday. "Not yet." That froze the moment.
"What the hell is that supposed to mean?"
Sunday used his forefinger to close the lids of the laptops. 1, 2, 3. If it had been anyone else, Kuga would have gotten up and comprehensively kicked their ass, maybe to the point of needing someone to dispose of a body. But this was Sunday. This was him. And so he sat very still.
"What do you want?" he asked.
"Oh," said Sunday. "Everything."
"The hell's that supposed to mean?"
"It means I'm delighted that you followed my advice about delegating so much of the organization to talented department heads. That's wise of you, but really, it's very convenient for me. After all, most of our customers, and really the world at large, see you not as a person, but a brand, kind of like Colonel Sanders. At the end of the day, does it really matter who wears the white suit and string necktie?" Kuga slipped his foot over to the alert button on the floor and pressed it. He said,
"You may be scary as hell, Sunday, but you'd better not be saying what it sounds like you're saying."
"I'm delighted that you're clever enough to understand the inference, bully for you." Then he cupped a hand around one ear. "Oh, wait. Is that the sound of no one coming to answer your call?" Kuga's eyes shifted to the door, which remained stubbornly shut. "It's just you and me, Harcourt," said Sunday. He reached into a pocket and drew out a glittering filleting knife. "And look, I brought something for us to play with."
Chapter 171. The Pavilion, Blue Diamond Elite Training Center, Stevens County, Washington. The semi began to roll. On the flatbed, three of the fighting machines were still firing, and now the fixers were all armed and adding to the barrage. The whole thing was a rolling engine of destruction. Mia turned and ran farther up the road, cut through a switchback, and headed toward the guard shack at full speed. Her plan needed cover, and it needed height, and she wanted to get to the shack, climb atop it, and then use that as a platform to jump onto the roof of the truck. If she could empty a magazine or two down through the roof and kill the driver, then maybe the truck would crash. And so she ran like hell. Bunny saw Mia running from the truck and tried to figure out what she was doing. But then he realized there was no time for that or for anything else. The fixers were going to get away, and even if they weren't likely to make it down to Fort Lauderdale in time to add to that attack, they would be free to do more damage. He had no doubt Kuga and Santoro could find other dreadful uses for those machines and all the highly trained and enhanced fixers.
"No damned way,"
he snarled as he launched himself down the road. He had nearly a full drum of the high explosives left. They may not pack enough punch to stop the fighting machines, but those grenades would do a lot of damage to that truck. He was even grinning as he ran. He was grinning when a fixer rose up from the shrubs right in his path. It wasn't an ambush, just bad luck. Bunny slammed into him at full speed, and the two of them fell and began rolling down the slope. Bunny's shotgun flew straight up into the air and vanished inside a holly bush. Top used Hot Mama to stomp on the other K-110, the titanium alloy feet of the fighting machine, backed by the entire weight of the device, and every ounce of cybernetically enhanced technology did what grenades couldn't do. It smashed the cowling in, crushing it, flattening it, and turning the driver within into a red horror.
"Yeah, and fuck you too," Top yelled.
Then he turned as bullets pinged off his own cowling. Two of the fixers were on their feet, eyes blazing red as the relentless chemicals flooded through their systems. One kept firing with his rifle while the other grabbed a 6-foot length of broken tree branch and swung it like a baseball bat at the machine. The blow was massive, and it staggered Top, making Hot Mama backpedal for balance. Top opened up with the minigun, driving the armed fixer back and down, but the one with the club kept swinging, going mad with it, laughing maniacally. Top tried to swat him away with the mechanical arm, but the fixer was fast and ducked under. The killer rose up before Top could check his swing and cracked the branch across the cowling again. The wood shattered, but a small crack appeared in the reinforced glass. The fixer dodged another swing, dived, and came up with a rock the size of a grapefruit. He dodged in again, smashing the stone with raw power, but also with precision, attacking the K-110's few weak spots. It was the kind of assault only someone who really understood the fighting machine would know to do. Out of his peripheral vision, Top saw Andrea kneeling behind the pump house, engaging the last two remaining fixers in a gun battle. One of them edged around to get a better angle, but three fast shots from the trees sent him sprawling backward, blood jetting from his throat. Bell, by intention or likelier an accident, had found the vulnerable sweet spot.
"Jackpot, fixer down, get out of the—"
It was all he got out before the fixer's body armor exploded. Chapter 172. The Playroom, undisclosed location, near Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada. There was no Mr. Sunday in the room anymore. That person had served his purpose and was gone. The skin that had made up the face of the salesman lay on the floor, still clutched in the bloody hand of what had been Harcourt Bolton Sr. There was no Harcourt Bolton anymore, either, not in any substantial way. All there was in the room now was Nicodemus. His filleting knife rested on one thigh of his crossed legs. The face that no longer belonged to Bolton lay wetly on his other thigh. Nicodemus tugged at it to make sure it lay flat, inspecting it for tears. There were none. No bruises, either. He'd been very careful not to damage the face. As for the rest of that man's body, it was sprawled nearby, open, ruined, no longer beautiful.
"Kruger,"
said Nicodemus, trying the name with a pleasurable sense of ownership.
"Kruger, yes."
His eyes were a swirling mix of awful greens and sickly yellows and reptile browns. His smile, although streaked with red, was so wide and bright and happy. Chapter 173. East Texas Convention Center, LaBorde, Texas. The fixers who chased me off were now spread through the crowd and causing all sorts of problems. There were a lot of bodies on the floor, and there was an atmosphere of mingled pain, confusion, and terror permeating the room. However this ended, this would be the news story for days. Which, I supposed, was another goddamned victory for Kuga. More proof that he could sell mayhem to his clients. As with terrorist groups, multinational corporations, and organized crime, there was no way to get a completely clean win. The world has never been that tidy. There was always a cost, and I could see that coin being paid all around me. Which made me all the more determined to stop Santoro. He enabled so much of this, his fingerprints were all over it. That had to stop, and he had to pay for what he did to my family. To so many families. I reached the door through which he'd gone and saw only one fixer guarding it, his eyes still normal, but sweat pouring down his face. I wondered if the enhancer aspects of Relentless were just hitting his bloodstream. How long before the rage kicked in? I didn't know and didn't care. He turned toward me and I shot him in the face. The Sandman dart caught him beside the nose and he staggered. Like the fixers at the processing plant, it affected him but didn't knock him out. So, as he reeled against the door, I used the knife. Yeah, that did the trick. I leaped over his body and crashed through the doorway. The hall was empty, except for a dead security guard. Poor bastard. I slowed from a fast run to a cautious walk as I approached the corner, then ducked low to take a quick look around the edge. Had I done that while standing, I would have died right there. A meat cleaver clunked into the wall at the level of where my throat had been, and I looked up into the sparkling blue and thoroughly insane eyes of Eve. She simultaneously tried to tear the cleaver free and kick me in the face. Bad moves, both of them. What she should have done was not be between me and Rafael Santoro, and I had no damned time to waste on junior-grade psychopaths. As I shot to my feet, I gutted her from navel to breastbone, gave the knife a big push and twist at the top, and sent the tip of the blade into her black heart. Eve looked at me with such profound confusion that it was as if she were trying to understand how this, her life, her ambitions, her goals, could simply end this quickly. Maybe she'd planned a drama for us, a big battle in which she would emerge victorious, or perhaps she thought her mentor, her daddy, would step in to save her. I tore my knife free and let her fall. Maybe I should have pity for the damage that drove her to become what she was. That's something for philosophers, and I'm not one of that brotherhood. I doubted I'd even mention her to Rudy. Why give her even that much? There was too much innocent blood on her hands for me to care. Santoro was 20 feet away, and he was grinning at me. I grinned, too. And I think my smile was a great deal darker than his. Chapter 174. The Pavilion. Blue Diamond Elite Training Center, Stevens County, Washington. Mia saw the blast through a gap in the trees. She heard Top's warning, and then a fireball enveloped his fighting machine. Then she was too busy to keep watching because the semi rounded the curve. It was packed with the remaining fixers and the K-110s. She crouched atop the guard shack, which had been abandoned by the soldiers who'd run down to join the fight. Sadly, there were no weapons there, and she still only had her pistol. It felt bizarrely inadequate against what was rolling toward her. And if she couldn't stop the driver, then this whole fight was for nothing. The help that was on the way, Bedlam team and the National Guard, were still at least 30 minutes out. If the truck got away, it could vanish into the massive surrounding forests.
"Come on, boys," she said under her breath. "Come and dance with the magpie."
She could see the driver, a burly man in the dark fixer's body armor, his head turned to one side, as he watched the last of the fight through the side-view mirror. On the flatbed, the fixers were still firing, but randomly now. No one was looking at her. The semi was going about 30 miles an hour and accelerating when she flung herself from her perch and onto the roof of the cab. Bunny and the fixer got to their feet. Neither had a gun anymore, having lost them in the collision. In his body armor, the fixer was broader and blockier than Bunny, but the big young man was taller and at the peak of his physical strength. His 6.5-foot-tall body was packed with corded muscle. Not the top-heavy bodybuilder muscles, but the springy and toned muscles of the professional athlete. A long time ago, he'd played volleyball in the Pan American Games, and had it not been for joining the Marines, he might have gone on to the Olympics. And during the years since, both Top and Colonel Ledger had taught him a lot about how fast a big man can be. He went right at the fixer and landed a massive overhand blow that drove the killer to one knee. Bunny immediately shifted weight and brought his knee up sharply to smash the fixer's nose. Then he boxed his ears with cupped hands. The fixer screamed but did not fall. Instead, in the space of a fractured second, his eyes went a burning red and his face became a mask of pure rage. Actual rage, as the bioweapon mixed with the relentless stamina enhancer turned man into monster. Bunny threw another punch, an overhand right that would have broken the man's neck had it landed, but the fixer moved fast, so fast. He blocked the punch and hit Bunny in the center of the chest with such appalling force that Bunny felt something break inside. His heart seemed to lurch, and suddenly there was not enough air left in the whole world. Chapter 175 East Texas Convention Center, Laborde, Texas.
"Hey," said Harry. "Look, there's Joe."
Toys barely heard Harry's comment. He was busy defending a group of church lady types from a juiced-up fixer, and that was proving to be much harder than he'd thought. Harry saw Joe Ledger edging around the far side of the crowd, and that made him frown. Was Joe leaving? And why had he stopped to change his clothes? Some kind of disguise? He ran across the room calling Ledger's name. Joe finally heard him when Harry was a dozen paces away. He turned. And that quickly the man stopped being Joe Ledger. He was the same height, build, color, even down to the eyes. The man smiled. "Hey," he said, "are you a friend of Joe's?"
"Yeah," said Harry. "Are you at the RTI?"
"Not exactly," said Michael Augustus Stafford as he raised his pistol and shot Harry Bolt twice in the chest. Toys shot the fixer in the eye with the Snellig, twice, once in each red eye. The man reeled back screaming, clawing at his face even as his knees buckled. He lingered there, blood and mess running down his cheeks. Toys shifted his weight and balance and kicked the fixer in the Adam's apple. He turned away from the dying man just in time to see Harry Bolt get shot. And he immediately recognized who it was who'd fired those shots. The anti-Ledger. Stafford. The world's most sought-after assassin. Toys glanced around for Violin, but she was in the thick of it.
"Bloody hell,"
he growled and went running, making maximum use of cover behind the flailing, fighting people. Stafford did not see him coming because he was looking for a different face in all that madness. Toys came up directly behind a burly Latino who was trying to load a pistol but kept fumbling the magazine. Toys gave him a sharp push that crashed him into Stafford. The Latino's gun and Stafford's went flying. Toys brought up his Snellig, but Stafford was cat-quick, and he blocked Toys' gun hand and hit him twice, sternum and high in the chest. It had been an attempt to stall with one punch and crush the throat with the other, a technique Toys himself liked, but it was the kind of thing one did with the great unwashed, not with another professional. Toys turned his head and dipped, forcing the punch to land on his cheekbone. It hurt, but he knew it would hurt Stafford a good deal more. The killer snatched back his hand but wasted no time complaining about the pain. Instead, he snapped out a very fast toe kick that, had it landed, would have done terrible damage to Toys' crotch. Toys took that on the hip and whipped out with a snapping back fist that knocked blood from Stafford's nose. There was the tiniest pause, much less than a second, where the two men saw each other, less for who and more for what they were. And then the battle was joined with savage, murderous intensity. Chapter 176 The Pavilion, Blue Diamond Elite Training Center, Stevens County, Washington. Bunny staggered back, his chest on fire from that blow over the heart. Fireworks exploded in the air, and he knew he was in real trouble. The fixer was superhumanly strong, and that blow had done serious damage. The choices were slim. Backpedal and try to run, or attack like a sick bear and try to drag the man down to the ground and see who knew the best dirty tricks. In both cases, the fixer had the edge. He was stronger, faster, and he was not yet hurt. The killer solved the matter by rushing Bunny, howling like a monster. Top Sims was in hell, and the fires were really damned hot. He fought to clear his head, to make sense of what was happening, and clarity of mind brought no comfort. He lay inside Hot Mama, and the fighting machine was wreathed in flame. Most of it was burning debris from when the fixer in the body armor had exploded, and even though the shell of his cybernetic battle suit was heat-resistant, the driver could still cook. Top fought to make the K-110's arms and legs move. They did, but not well. The blast had seriously damaged the servos. He threw all his muscle into turning over. It seemed to take an age, but he finally thudded down on his chest. Next, he brought the hands up. No, just the left was working. The right arm of the machine wouldn't move at all. Lifting the ponderous suit one-handed was agony. His back was burning in a different way. Something was wrong. A sprain, a strain. He prayed to God it wasn't worse. When the blast happened, he'd been thrown and hit rolling. The suit was never intended to protect the driver from something like that. He heard gunfire and knew the battle was still going on, so he couldn't have been out for more than a few seconds. Where was Andrea? He'd been by the pump house, but had no tech to shield him from either blast or blaze. Top got to his knees, and after 10,000 years, to his feet. Walking was a special kind of hell, but with each step, the burning debris fell away, and after 10 steps he was out of the fire. He hit the release, and the dying K-110 spilled him out into the dirt. Mia Cleave clung to the roof of the cab, fighting to steady herself, sloughing off the extra momentum from her jump while compensating for the semi's acceleration. She grinned. They didn't teach this in the regular army. The truck was heading out toward the main road. Once it got there, it would accelerate to 60 or 70, and that would be the end of her. She had to stop it. Now. With her hand braced against an exhaust stack, the heat intense even through her gloves, she knelt above the driver's seat, drew her pistol, and aimed the barrel straight down. She knew the consequences. The fixer was wearing body armor, and there was every chance it was going to blow up if she scored a kill shot. Could she kill him and have time to get clear? The roof of the cab was 13 or 14 feet in the air, and the truck was now going at least 40 miles an hour. The jump would probably break every bone in her body.
Yeah, she said. Well, you can kiss my ass.
And she fired. The 6-hour P226 had a 20-round extended magazine, and she fired every last bullet she had. The slide locked back, and the truck instantly began to sluice sideways. Mia had to let go of the empty gun to hold on. There was a patch of grass coming up fast on the right, and she scrambled to the passenger side, tensed to spring, and her first bullet had punched down through the top of the driver's head, stopping thought, control, breath, and life. His body armor reacted to the sudden drop in pulse, and it blew up. The explosion punched backward, blowing out the rear of the cab and killing 4 of the fixers in the back. Their suits blew as well. Mia never made it off the roof of the cab. She was caught inside a thermobaric fireball that lifted the entire semi, the crated and uncrated fighting machines, all the fixers, and 3/4 of an acre of road and forest, and threw it all, burning, into the air. At virtually the same moment, in one of those cosmic coincidences that seemed to be part of the life and death of Tier 1 Special Operations, there was another explosion nearly 3,000 miles away. 2 blasts, really, seconds apart, as a pair of AIM-120 AMRAAM missiles hit the fixer troop transport planes. One missile struck just as the first K-110 was trundling toward the cargo hatch, ready to drop into the concert stadium. 88 fixers and 16 fighting machines, along with the planes and flight crews, filled the sky with fireballs that could be seen for 50 miles in every direction. Bell walked out of the woods, her rifle raised, but no one left to shoot. Top Sims sat on the ground, his back to the pumphouse wall, with an unconscious Andrea leaning against him. Except for skin color, they could have been father and son. Bell checked on them and was relieved to find out that, though hurt, they were still alive. It took longer to find Bunny. He was on a slope, wrapped in a tangle with a fixer. Both men were unconscious. Both were battered into bloody hulks. Bell could not wake Bunny up. His pulse was thin, and his breathing too quick and shallow. The fixer's breathing was labored and kept stopping. That alarmed her, and she ran down to the buildings and found a tarp. It took every ounce of her strength to get Bunny onto the tarp and then pull him down the slope and into a drainage ditch. When the fixer's heart stopped and his suit detonated, Bell covered Bunny with her own body. It was nearly 15 minutes before the first choppers arrived. Chapter 177, East Texas Convention Center, Labord, Texas. Santoro's smile was genuine, but it wasn't happy. It was a rictus grin, and in it were stress and anger, grief and shock, and a hatred so palpable it was like a fist. I'd killed his pet, his adopted daughter, his, well, whatever else she was. I'd also blundered right into the heart of his operation. He had no idea that there was maybe 5% skill, and the rest either blind, dumb luck, or the perversity of the gods of war, or some combination thereof. What mattered was that I was here to end his plan and end him. We'd fought twice before. The first time was aboard a cruise liner for the Sea of Hope event, another charity fundraiser like Going Viral. We'd fought and he whipped me and Ghost. If Mr. Church hadn't come along at the right moment, that would have been the end of us. Church kicked Santoro's ass and then threw him into a black site prison. The second time was late last year at the D9 conference in Oslo. We'd beaten each other half to death, and maybe I'd gotten the upper hand at the end of it. Not sure, because right as things were going my way, I took a blast of rage in the face. Next thing I remember is waking up cuffed to a bed because, apparently, I'd tried to kill Church and Bell. However, Bell shot me with Sandman. This was round three, and the math had changed a lot since last year. Santoro had murdered my entire family. He killed everyone I was related to by blood or marriage. The bomb that killed them all nearly killed Junie, and in that moment something died in me, and something was born. Church thinks that Nicodemus infected me with the darkness. Maybe he did, but if so, it was an infection laid down on top of something already boiling out of the lowest places in my soul. Maybe the reason that the darkness did not turn me suicidal or make me take innocent lives was that it was not wholly a product of Nicodemus's magic, if magic was even the right word. Whatever that trickster son of a bitch did to me was added to what Santoro had already conjured in the dark soil of my damaged psyche. The poet Baudelaire wrote about flowers of hate. Yes, they have grown wild in me, yielding strange fruits. I didn't rush at Santoro, or he at me. It was as if the madness outside this room no longer belonged to either of us. This hallway was the whole world. I raised the Snellig barrel pointed to the ceiling. He had a Beretta in his waistband, and he took it out with two fingers. We nodded, and each set our weapons down on the floor and kicked them away. Then I took the Wilson knife and drove the point an inch deep into the wall. Santoro nodded again and removed a stiletto from a concealed sheath and did the same. Now we were unarmed. I have plenty of soldier friends, who would think this was stupid? Two grown professionals in the middle of a war fighting a duel, but those people weren't here. They weren't Santoro or me. They weren't in our heads or hearts. They didn't share our histories. They couldn't and wouldn't understand, nor would their understanding matter. They, like the rest of the world, did not exist for us as we walked slowly toward one another. There were no taunts, no jibes, no trash talk. His eyes were filled with strange lights. I could once more see shadows creeping into the corners of my awareness. In my heart, the darkness was struggling to break free. It wanted this as much as I did. The darkness did not share its reasons with me, and I did not allow it to see into my mind. There were fewer than 6 feet between me and Rafael Santoro. I think we both moved at exactly the same moment. Chapter 178. East Texas Convention Center, Laborde, Texas. Toys had never fought anyone as brutal and quick as Stafford. Of course, he'd never fought Joe Ledger, and he imagined this was what it would be like. No flashy moves, no concessions to style, just combat. Stafford's technique was basic, but his speed and power were incredible. From the beginning of the fight, Toys realized that he was very likely going to die. Stafford feinted high and ducked low, throwing a short, vicious hook to Toys' groin, but the young man twisted aside and once more forced the punch to hit bone. Same hand. First the cheekbone, and then the hip. This time, Toys saw pain flicker across Stafford's face. The man shifted left and kicked at Toys, catching him on the thigh with the flat of the heel and knocking him 8 feet back. It was a ploy, Toys realized, even as it was happening, so Stafford could catch a breath, because a few seconds ago, Toys had tucked a nice one into the assassin's gut with a straight right. Toys got his balance, but did not charge right in. He needed a moment, too. They'd traded a flurry of crushing punches in the first 2 seconds, and both of them had knuckle cuts across their faces. Toys spat blood onto the floor between them.
"Who the hell are you, anyway?" asked Stafford.
"The ghost of Christmas yet to come," said Toys.
"Okay, sure," said Stafford. "Whatever."
And midway through that last word, he moved, darting forward almost like a fencer with a step-drag motion that closed the gap while giving him a springy and balanced stance for a left-jab-right hook combination, which was exactly what Toys expected him, wanted him to do. He'd shifted to look like his weight was resting on his heels and let his arms sag as if too weary to keep his guard up. Stafford, the faster boxer, blitzed in. Toys crouched a little and leaned away from the jab, but into the line of the hook. The punch was so fast that Toys hadn't yet braced his bald fists against his head so that his whole body would absorb and slough off the foot-pounds of impact. Stafford's punch knocked Toys' own fist into his left eye socket. But Stafford's already damaged right hand hit the bent elbow. The hand, for all the powerful things it can do, is remarkably fragile and made up of many small bones. The elbow, when bent double, is a club, a big knot of bone. Stafford's fist hit that unyielding bone at 30 miles an hour. His knuckles exploded, driving sections of bone deep into the muscle and cartilage of the hand. Splinters of bone shot out through the skin, and all those bundles of nerve endings shrieked. Stafford reeled back in agony, and Toys, dazed and bleeding, took his moment. He skipped forward with an instep snap to Stafford's groin, and as the man folded, Toys grabbed his hair with both hands and dropped into a low squat. The motion, the sudden deadweight drop of his body, slammed Stafford face forward onto the concrete floor. Toys fell sideways, his elbow on fire and his head ringing so loudly it was like church bells on Christmas morning. But he knew he could not stop, so he got to his knees and crawled to his enemy, swung a foot over so he straddled the man at mid-back, looped an arm under Stafford's head, and cinched it tightly around the neck. But he was not trying to choke the man. Instead, he clamped his other hand around the wrist of the looped arm and simply sat down. He did it as a limp drop and then jerked backward with all his strength. The motion jerked Stafford's head up and back, too far back and too quickly. There was a double crack, crack, as the man's neck broke, and then the spine between the shoulder blades. Toys let go and collapsed onto the floor beside the man he'd just killed. Violin shot a fixer 4 times before the Sandman took him down, but he collapsed before he reached her, his hands brushing her boot as he landed face down on the floor. Behind him, a tall, slender black woman and a shorter, heavier white woman were fighting like cats, snarling and biting and rolling around on the floor. Violin shot them too. It occurred to her that it would simply be easier to shoot everyone instead of trying to pick who was a fixer, who was a duped militiaman or radical, and who was a civilian caught up by the hysteria of violence. She had 6 magazines for her gun, each of which carried 30 darts. That was more than enough to put a third of the room down. So, she began firing. Violin's weapon of choice was a sniper rifle, and she had been the one to train Bell in the art, but Lilith had required that she be proficient with every kind of gun, long or short, just as she was highly skilled with any edged weapon. Years of experience had given her timing and savvy, and refined her battlefield judgment. And so she put her back to a wall and targeted the people with guns first, taking them down before they were aware of her. Then, as bodies began to pile up around her, she shot whoever was closest, and the person directly behind them. Civilians scattered, and she let them go. The patsy militants tried to outshoot her, but she was the better, faster, more accurate, and less emotional shot. Fixers took several rounds each, but she had darts to spare. It was only after she'd built a landscape of drugged bodies that she saw 2 distinct things that broke her concentration. To her left, Toys sprawled next to a clearly dead Michael Augustus Stafford. Oddly, Toys reached up and patted Stafford's cheek before that hand flopped back down. To her right, a young man crawled toward her with a terrible slowness, leaving a snail's trail of shining red behind him. Blood bubbled from his lips and there were tears in his eyes.
"Harry!"
she cried and broke into a run. Chapter 179 East Texas Convention Center, Labourd, Texas. Santoro dropped and pivoted to swing a vicious Muay Thai shin kick to the outside of my left knee, but I was already in motion with a cutting palm to his chin. Because I was pivoting, his shin hit my knee straight and bent, which did no damage but hurt us both. A lot. My cutting palm missed his chin because he was pivoting and banged off his forehead. The 2 blows buffeted us backward. Pain meant nothing to Santoro, and it meant even less to me, so we closed again, only slightly warier. We were evenly matched for speed. He was smaller and could move his whole mass more quickly. I had a longer reach. He tried a stamp, missed my instep, but mashed my big toe, but I crouched and twisted and drove a 2-knuckle punch into the center of his quads. He hissed and chopped me across the side of the mouth with the edge of his hand. My lips split, and droplets of blood followed his hand like the tail of a comet. I fainted with a low roundhouse kick, but then tilted forward to try to put my thumb in his eye. He parried my shot and caught me under the arm with a short, chopping uppercut. It numbed my arm, as he knew it would, and he tried to close on that side, but I pivoted in place and swung a spinning elbow at his nose. Santoro leaned into me to nullify the force of the blow, but I'm a big guy and I hit hard, so the sheer torsion I'd generated sent him stumbling sideways. I tried to correct my balance and follow, but I was still at the end of a pivot, and by the time I'd shifted my stance, he was out of range and beginning to circle. We played that cat game of walking in opposing circles for a few seconds, reading each other, waiting for the moment, stalking each other on the balls of our feet, knees bent, able to move in any direction. That's how the pros do it. That's what they try to teach students on the first day in the dojo. Don't be flat-footed. Keep your weight balanced. Don't root yourself to the ground. I sprang at him, using my left hand to chop down on his guard while I looped my right up and over and down with a smashing palm heel. He was fast. My Lord, he was fast. I had him cold, and he still managed to twist and contort his body to empty the space where he'd just been. A matador would weep for such an evasion. A dancer would kill for that grace. His evasion turned into a counterattack as, with his back briefly toward me, he kicked up backward in a deer kick that caught me high on the inner thigh with his heel. I was not wearing underwear, and my balls were right there directly in the path of the kick. It hurt. Real fucking bad. Here's the thing about pain, though. Unless the pain is coupled with debilitating damage, it's just sensation. It can be dealt with. It can be endured and even disregarded. Every boxer knows this. Every soldier injured in combat while still 100 yards from cover knows it. Marathon runners know it. And so do teenagers playing soccer on a Sunday morning. Getting hit in the balls hurts. In a civilized moment, you tend to curl up into a fetal position and pray for death. In action, though, when it's not only your life, but the lives of everyone who needs you, counts on you, depends on you, it becomes something else. It becomes fuel. The pain galvanized me, and I hurled myself at Santoro, trying to drive him against the wall, but he was already turning, having seen or sensed my jump. He slapped his arm around my waist, turned away, bent over, and used his hip as a fulcrum and my mass and momentum to throw me onto the floor. But I grew up in jiu-jitsu schools. Throws and counter-throws, or counters to counters, that's my thing. If I'd fed him that technique, it could not have been more ideal. As I landed, I turned like an axle and made him the wheel. The new torque whipped him around me, and then he was on the floor and I was on top. Last year in Oslo, he'd had a dominant moment like that, and instead of ending it right there, decided to beat me to death. He'd knocked out teeth, fractured an eye socket, and busted bones in my face. He could have used that time to kill me, and it gave me a chance to turn the tables on him, and damn if I hadn't done the same thing. I'd wanted to punish him for the deaths of the helpless and innocent people on the islands where the rage pathogen was released. I should have killed him. Like Santoro a moment before, I could have killed him. Both of us had made the mistake of succumbing for the need to use our blows as punishment and as a lesson. Know this. Understand this. Be aware of why you are being beaten. That's its own kind of arrogance. The price I paid for that was him slipping away and then coming after my family. Their deaths were on me. On me. I completed my role, and for a moment I was on top, straddling him, my hands free, and the darkness tried to own me. It rose up like a tsunami of utter blackness. It wanted Santoro punished. It wanted to dominate, to own, to humiliate, to educate. I could feel it spreading through me like a jar of ink poured into a gallon of water. The tendrils uncurled along the paths of least resistance, filled every nerve ending, every muscle fiber. I could feel it behind my eyes, and I wondered if they had turned as black as the fixer's eyes turned red. I believed that if I opened my mouth, I would vomit out a cloud of Stygian horror. It wanted to steal this moment from me. And in doing so, give Santoro a chance. In the past, he'd proven that all he ever needed was a chance. The darkness was so powerful that I was becoming lost in it, just as I was aware that all of this was happening inside the bubble of a millisecond. I was the darkness now, and an awareness stabbed through me, whispering awful truths. If I gave this moment to the darkness, then it would have all my moments henceforth. If I became the darkness, then everything that I was, that Joe Ledger was, would be gone. Nicodemus would win. Kuga would win. Rafael Santoro would win because he would have eradicated, however indirectly, the entire Ledger family for all time. If I yielded to the darkness, then that would be where I lived, forever. And there would be no other home to go to. There would be no Junie. There would be no joy, no love, no light. The milliseconds stretched and snapped. Santoro and I were just coming out of the roll. I was only then straddling him, looking down at him. In the next moment, he would react. and so I struck him under the chin with my left palm, tilting his head back, exposing his throat, and I slammed a full fist punch down. I put every ounce of my rage, my hurt, my loss into that punch, crushing his throat, breaking his neck, ending him. I gave everything I had to that punch. I killed him, goddammit. Not the darkness, goddammit. I did. Joe Ledger. Epilogue. 1. Even the longest night ends. After darkness, there is light. 2. They medevaced Harry Bolt to the best hospital in the region. Violin went with him, holding his slack hands in both of hers. He was rushed into surgery, and the doctors worked on him all night. I got there hours later. The aftermath at the venue was titanic, and I was the center of a hell of a lot of suspicion and scrutiny, despite my credentials. It wasn't until phones started ringing in the right hands and voices representing frightening levels of officialdom told them to leave me the hell alone that they did. Bug made sure my name and face were erased from every news story. That must have pushed Mind Reader to its limits, but it wasn't the first time I'd been edited out of a slice of history, which was perfectly fine by me. While I sat with Violin and Toys in the waiting room, I got two calls. The first was from Scott Wilson. He told me about the fight at the pavilion. Bunny, Top, and Andrea were all in a Spokane hospital. They were alive, but each was badly banged up. Andrea had burns and lacerations from flying debris. He was in the best shape. Top had some damage to his lower back, but Church was flying in the top spine doctor in the world. No joke. Church has a lot of friends. As for Bunny, he had a broken sternum, 4 broken ribs, a cracked collarbone, and 3 broken fingers. His fiancée Lydia, who was once a shooter back in the DMS days, was flown in one of Church's jets, and a nurse was along for company because Lydia was entering her third trimester. But we lost Mia Cleave. She'd gone down hard and taken out the last major lingering threat from the Relentless program. The word hero is bandied about too much. Football hero, guitar hero. There are actual heroes, though. There's no way to calculate how many lives her actions saved. I liked her and had planned to see about her getting a transfer to Havoc team. Now, she would be a star on a wall at Phoenix House. Tales would be told, drinks raised. The public at large would never hear her name. Never know how much intelligence and courage it took for her to stop that truck. Those of us who understand the nature of that sacrifice, though, no. We wouldn't ever forget. I shared all this with Toys and Violin. Toys merely grunted. He had stitches and bruises and looked like he'd been the star attraction at a muggers convention. Then Church called me to say that Junie was flying in. That news came closer to breaking me than anything else. I had to go into the men's room and just stand there for a while. I used a trash can to block the door. When I came out, Toys was alone.
"They called her in," he said.
"Harry?" Toys took a moment.
"They use the phrase cautiously optimistic."
"Shit.
Yes."
We sat. Time lost all meaning. Finally, without looking at him, I said,
"About Rotterdam. Mind if I just sum it up?"
"Yeah, sure."
"Fuck you."
I nodded.
"Fair enough."
We sat. "Are you regretting the whole going into the field thing?" He took so long that I didn't think he was going to answer.
Actually, he said, I haven't enjoyed myself this much in years.
Okay, I said.
Okay, he said. But seriously, and I mean this with my whole heart, Ledger.
Fuck you.
We nodded to one another and lapsed into a long silence. That was me and Toys. 3. The authorities arrested 11 fixers at the convention center. With Rafael Santoro dead, they seemed a whole lot less hesitant about making deals for reduced sentences in exchange for telling every damned thing they knew, and they knew a lot. Since that day in La Borde, there have been close to 300 subsequent arrests, and with Interpol, Mossad, MI6, Barrier, and a slew of other agencies involved, that tally was likely to rise. As for Kuga, only one fixer knew about his mansion in Canada, but by the time the CRMP descended on it in a swarm of helicopters, there was nothing left to find. Some blood in what was clearly Kuga's office, and it was a DNA match with Harcourt Bolton, but no bodies, no computers, no anything. One odd little detail that I got from one of the Mounties was that the whole area, from driveway to the backyard to the eaves of the house, was covered with thousands of black birds. 4. On a sultry night in early September, I lay on a towel at the high tide line in a small cove of a secluded beach in Kauai. The sun was just starting to edge toward the horizon, the light through the clouds smearing the sky with every color in the paint box. Less than 100 feet from the beach, 2 juvenile dolphins leaped and splashed and played, and a big old green sea turtle crawled out of the crystal water and stopped to doze near me. I looked into his ancient, wise eyes and saw peace and understanding there that went miles and miles deep. There was a splash, and I saw Junie come out of the water, pulling off her mask and snorkel. Water sluiced down her long legs, and her blonde hair hung in salty rat tails down the front of one shoulder. She wore a bikini that made no attempt to hide the scars time and hard use had cut into her skin. She was then, and forever, the most beautiful and complex woman I have ever known. And I've known a few. She saw me watching her, and a smile blossomed on her face. There are few smiles like that, full of understanding and grace, full of love, insight. As deep as that turtle's, but with a different kind of awareness. A keen intelligence and childlike joy at simply being alive. Junie came and sank down next to me. She stretched out, and we kissed for a long, long time. Then she made a pillow out of my left bicep, snuggled close, and we watched the magnificence of the sky. Even though this was the beginning of the long, slow Hawaiian evening, the sky was filled with light. And there was not a trace of darkness to be seen anywhere. This is Ray Porter. Thank you for listening to Relentless, a Macmillan Audio production from St. Martin's Griffin. This program was produced by Katie Rabitsky. Text copyright 2021 by Jonathan Mayberry. Production copyright 2021 by Macmillan Audio. All rights reserved.